I'd like to start by acknowledging the unceded Coast Salish territories that we're gathered on here today. And I've been asked to talk about some of the links between Canada's foreign and domestic policy and to make the links between some of the things that Manuel and John spoke about and Canada's quote-unquote internal policies towards, largely I'm going to talk about Indigenous and migrant populations and communities. And I think the importance of that, and I'm grateful to be able to speak to this topic, is a fewfold. One is that in as much as Canada on a global level, along the lines of what John and Manuel talked about, presents itself as a peacekeeper, and there's this mythology of Canada as a peacekeeping nation, and that some of what we see today in terms of Canada's occupation of Afghanistan, many of us believe or were told to believe that this is an aberration when in fact this is part and parcel of Canada's historic role in the world in terms of interventions not only in Afghanistan but in Iraq, but in Haiti, in East Timor, in Vietnam. Similarly, domestically, if you will, this mythology of multiculturalism and of human rights is actually one of deep embedded racism and colonization towards, again, Indigenous communities and migrant communities. So in much as we can disrupt that at a global level, that disruption is required locally. And in fact, much of this agenda at a global level we can see has actually been built on projects of internal colonization and exclusion that allows for Canada's role in a global level. And so we have to begin by acknowledging how this internal project allows for this global project to actually happen. And that also some of what we think about, particularly as an anti-war, as a peace movement, is the ability to talk about Canada in the global scene. And it's unfortunate that at large as a movement, there's an inability to often look at our own backyard, if you will, right? So that kind of cliche that it becomes hard and it becomes almost hypocritical to talk about those others over there without realizing that those others exist amongst us and are within us on a daily basis. And that exploitation, that police brutality, that violence of colonization affects all of us here today. And arguably, there's much more that we can do locally because these are people in our communities, these are governments that we can hold accountable in our own backyards again. And that it, by looking at Canada, and it's no longer rhetorical, but when we put forward the question of Canada, is Canada a country, is Canada a colony, which is sort of this ideology that we're seeing in relationship to the U.S., that no, in fact, what Canada is a colonizer, right? And we see that again locally and globally, that Canada is not just a victim of the United States and that all of the policies that Canada has engaged in is not an aberration, but it's a long legacy and a long history of colonization at the local and global level. And to understand this project, as John said, is not just a new thing that happens every single day. And in the local context, it's important to realize that post 9/11 is just a reinvention of a legacy that is much older. Post 9/11, there is no pre-9/11 to return to in the context of domestic policy that is somehow more bright than post 9/11. What we see in post 9/11 is a racialization of particular communities, the Arab and Muslim communities. Prior to that, there was a racialization of communities like the Japanese-Canadian community that was interned after World War II, where we saw in BC, 22,000 Japanese-Canadians who were interned because they were believed to be enemy aliens. And again, the only affiliation that they had was that they were Japanese. In the same way that most Arab, Muslim, or South Asian Canadians are believed to be terrorists, and that discourse of enemy, alien, and terrorism is also one that's evolved, and you can see those similarities. So again, it's to be able to view this as a project that is longstanding. So I want to start by just talking about some of the roots of how the local and global links are made in terms of some of the discourse. And I think discourse is important. I like discourse mostly because it allows us to ground ourselves in a movement that becomes relevant. So for example, in the same way that in the anti-war movement, when we say things like, we are losing the war, therefore we need to withdraw, that to me is troubling because if we were winning the war, what does that mean? We would stay? And what does losing mean? Does losing mean because Canadian troops are dying at a rate that most Canadians didn't expect? Is that our idea of losing? Or is losing the fact that we shouldn't be there, period? There's nothing to win or lose in an imperialist occupation. So similarly, discourse is really important, and our analysis is really important if we're to understand how we're to ground ourselves in solidarity with local struggles. And much of this, again, you can mimic with global struggles. So much of Canada's legacy with communities of color, with Indigenous communities, immigrants of color, migrants, migrant workers, refugees, is rooted in a lot of moral panic. And I want to go through some of these different ones. I want to start with, first of all, which is the most recent idea, is this idea that immigrants and Indigenous communities are somehow less civilized than Canadians are. And we see this in post-9/11, several examples, but again, there's so many more. This idea of Indigenous people as savage, the fact that residential schools were justified in the name of Indigenous people needing to be cultured, needing to be taught English. Our minister right now, Minister of Immigration Jason Kenney, is saying that immigrants need to learn English or French in order to immigrate to Canada, is saying that immigrants need to understand Canadian values. In Quebec, we had the whole reasonable accommodation debate, which basically said that in Quebec, immigrants weren't assimilating to a Quebecois culture. And at the root of that is this idea of, well, what the hell is Canadian values? And how are Indigenous people and people of color and migrants not somehow part of Canadian values? Because if those communities are inherently positioned as opposite to Canadian values, then the only thing we're really left with is this unfortunate and very uncomforting reality and truth that then Canadian values basically mean white supremacist Eurocentric values. Because if every single time communities of color are labeled as hyphenated citizens, every time people are asked, well, where are you really from? I'm from Vancouver. No, where are you really from? East Van. No, where are you really from? It means that despite centuries and centuries of residence on these unceded territories, you're not actually considered Canadian enough. And that immigrant becomes, it's not a legal term, it's a euphemism for racialized, right? People may be Canadian, but they're still considered immigrant populations simply because they're not white, essentially. And so that discourse is one that we see, again, in a global level, because this idea of savage, of needing to be civilized, of needing to be assimilated, of needing to be taught civilization is something that we know happens in Afghanistan, for example, but we're not as readily able to recognize it when it happens here. We know that when the Canadian government says that the occupation of Afghanistan is because we want to bring human rights to Afghanistan, because we want to liberate Afghani women, because we think that Afghanis don't know how to run their own country, we know that that is full of bullshit. It's a racist ideology, it's an imperialist ideology, and certainly bombing country does never bring liberation to women, right? Women's liberation will never be won at the barrel of a gun. And similarly, we need to be able to understand that when we're talking about the ways in which Indigenous communities and communities of color are impacted by these very insidious racist ideologies of civilizational discourse, of assimilation, forced assimilation, against our communities and populations. And some of the examples I want to draw on is actually to use the model that John talked about, the 3Ds. The 3Ds, as John said, is an established, especially increasingly established doctrine of foreign policy, development, diplomacy, and defense. And a lot of these, although not explicitly stated, but if you separate them out, and counterinsurgency in general, counterinsurgency as a model was actually learnt in a local context. So the counterinsurgency model that DND uses in terms of Afghanistan, Haiti, Iraq, increasingly we will see being used in Pakistan. It's already being used in Pakistan by the Obama administration, increasingly by the Canadian administration, was built on primarily counterinsurgency models that were used against Indigenous populations. The Oka crisis, the Gustafson Lake crisis, which is the largest paramilitary operation in Canadian history, took place in Gustafson Lake, in the interior of BC, in this province, Iprawash in 1995, and predating that, the Northwest Rebellion. All of these form the model for Canada's global counterinsurgency techniques that are used. Secret prisons that we talk about in the post-9/11 climate, a lot of the secret prison models came from Canada's internal secret prisons that were used to detain not just security certificate detainees that people know about, but a lot of the prisons that are currently holding refugees who are held on a really arbitrary section of the Immigration and Refugee Protection Act are held in prisons that are part and parcel of the criminal prisons but are not defined as as separate prisons. So there's a population of immigrants and refugees that are being held in Canada that have never been quantified, records of which have never been released, the numbers of whom are totally unknown, who have been held on security grounds since at least the late 1970s. Not since 9/11, but since at least the late 1970s. And so similarly, ideas of development and diplomacy, and to, you know, the idea of NGOs and development aid as playing a critical role in occupying countries, a lot of the model of NGOs as secular missionaries actually comes from the missionaries. And the idea that NGOs can be used to, as secular missionaries in the so-called third world came from ideologies of the ways in which, and this can be traced through a lot of CETA's own reports, and the ways in the critical role in which in Canada missionaries played a role to civilize, re-educate, and essentially try to fundamentally change the culture, and often the culture of resistance that Manuel was talking about, to bring about these sorts of changes in quote-unquote communities within Canada. And so just to wrap up with some sort of tangible things, I think one of the most fundamental ways in which foreign policy relates to quote-unquote local policy is this idea that if we realize the brutal violence that is impacting so many different parts of the world due to both Canadian corporate interests, whether it's mining being a major one, Canada being a lead player in mining operations, particularly in Latin America and South Asia, or Canada's military roles, particularly in places like the Middle East, the human impact of these violences that are being forced on people is human migration. The fact that there are 20 million people who are being forced to migrate every single year, largely due to poverty, insecurity, war, trade agreements, is this reality of human migration. So when we talk about immigrants, this isn't about charity. This isn't about let's let more people in. Maybe Canada can handle some more. It's about a moral and ethical responsibility that as an imperialist country, as a colonizing country, we are responsible for the forced displacement of millions of people every single year. In Afghanistan, there are millions of people, women, children, families, who have been displaced as a result of the most current occupation. And Canada prides itself for having let in 2,000 Afghan refugees, right? And so this is about a moral responsibility to say that if Canada, and if we as Canadians, people who reside in Canada, are going to fight the war, then we're also responsible for the human impact that is created by this war, which isn't just about going ahead and giving aid, but if people are saying, you've ruined our country, what responsibility are you going to take for our displaced lives? We have to struggle with that. And what right do we have to say that we want every single sweatshop to be closed in the third world, but you have no right to live amongst us with dignity while we're fighting that fight for you? That becomes very hypocritical. And so I think, just to end, and there's so many other kind of connections, the SPP is a big one, but to really struggle with the fact that the local and the global are so deeply embedded, and that if we are to have any meaningful impact at a global level, it's to also force ourselves to realize what impacts can we have at a local level and to hold governments accountable here in our own backyards and to sit with the fact that every single day there are thousands of deportations. Every single day in Vancouver, people are thrown into jail in the downtown east side. Very close to here, as a result of the Olympics, people are throwing up blockades and fighting for the land. What responsibility are we going to have to that? And to really ask ourselves those questions in order to have any sort of meaningful change here. Thank you.